I was listening to one podcast, a fairly like big podcast, and one of the podcasters was like, "Oh my god, when did Brad Pitt get hot?" And I'm like,
"What?"
I'm like, "What?" I was like, "Where were you for the past 20 odd years?
Do you not remember a Shania Twain song that?"
Hi, and welcome to the episode of Cinema Nation. My name is Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Thomas Horton.
And with each new episode of Cinema Nation, we delve into subgenres of film or trends of film, years of film. Usually we have our very own Ben Gertz on the show where Thomas and myself pitch Ben on movies. But again, with us being in all these different cities, Thomas being in Atlanta, me in LA, and Ben in Portland, it's sometimes hard to plan to get us all together. And so we don't have Ben here. We don't have a movie we can pitch. Maybe we should pitch Ben at the very end if he was here, like what we should give him. But yeah, so when Thomas and I are here alone, we kind of have to figure out another topic to tackle outside of subgenres. And I feel like an easy thing to talk about, and an interesting thing to me that's always been interesting, is talking about specific years in film. And Thomas and I, we did one a little while back on 2010. And also, I find it fitting, too, because we're in 2019 right now. We're towards the end of a decade. It's kind of interesting to look back on the decade as a whole, and then we're going to break it apart by year. So 2010 was our last one. Today, we're going to do 2011. And I guess to start it off, Thomas, I guess we need to provide a little bit of context of what happened in 2010 for people that don't remember from our episode.
Mm-hmm.
And with our last episode, we kind of up 2010. We talked about the big thing was Social Network was that year. It was Social Network. It was Inception. It was Toy Story 3. One of the big things was that there's only one superhero film that year with Iron Man 2. And 2010 was also kind of a reaction year to Avatar. I think we're getting with 2010 and then continuing 2011, we're getting the end of like the big franchises of the 2000s.
I think one thing to remind people, because something we're going to focus on a lot is kind of like what actors were coming up and really establishing themselves in 2011. And in talking about one actor in particular, we'll also be discussing a movie that was kind of a continuation, because we talked a lot in 2010 about the rise of Emma Stone with Easy A, and we're going to continue to see her star rise in this episode, and to see her star merge with someone else who would become kind of, I guess their careers would become entwined for a while.
Yeah, we're going to see. We talked about Emma Stone last. We talked a little bit about Jennifer Lawrence. We talked about Jonah Hill a little bit as well with Get Him to the Greek. So with this one, so there's an interesting argument online through certain film critics and through friends of mine where they talk about how 2011 is one of the greatest year of films. I have never really thought this. I think there's some really good films in 2011, and we'll talk about at the very end, I think especially in comparison to 2010. But a thing that was brought up to me that I think also goes with our show is that a buddy of mine, Logan, who's a listener of the podcast, told me he's talking about how like 2011 is kind of the year where genres became legitimized. And that's a very interesting perspective to take. And so we have a list on Letterboxd, through my Letterboxd, called Moneyball, a look at 2011 in film. And when we look at a lot of the top films of that era or that year, I think Logan's kind of right that genres are becoming are at least the most remembered of that year and were the most popular of that year. And so Thomas, with kind of the first few films that to go with that idea, the first few films you see, what kind of pops out at you that kind of goes with that idea of like genre becoming legitimized, in some cases being subverted?
Well, I think the thing that really sticks out, and you've already kind of talked about it coming over from 2010, is we had three pretty major superhero releases in 2011. I think 2010 was the last year where people could be like, oh yeah, the superhero movie this year. I mean, we're at the point now where Marvel put out Marvel Studios prior to being this. They still weren't Disney at this point, right? That was like 2013.
Disney, I think, might have. That's a good question. It's around that time. I'll get the verification on
but,
that.
But there are two Marvel Studios films this year: Captain America: The First Avenger, so the very first Captain America movie, and Thor: The First Thor movie, mm-hmm. as well as X-Men: First Class, which I consider one of the superior X-Men films.
I agree with that. In some cases, the best X-Men film, if you yeah. would, to some people,
and really, really revitalized the X-Men, the Fox X-Men franchise, for better or for worse. And at least gave Fox another 8 years of holding out before to make their own superhero movies before Disney would swallow them. So yeah, I think that's a really interesting leap to go from one superhero movie in 2010, especially it being a superhero sequel.
Yeah.
And so now is when you really start seeing the groundwork laid for the Avengers and for what would become the Marvel Studios empire, with two pretty risky origin story movies. Like,
yeah,
there was no guarantee that some Australian guy that nobody had ever heard of was going to do well as a space god, or that this guy who everybody knew as being really sarcastic in comedies and being the Human Torch in the bad Fantastic Four movies was going to be any decent as Captain America.
Yeah, it's you kind of like it doesn't make any sense. It makes it like, I remember when it was happening, when they're like, they're announcing the movies, and it's like no one knew who Chris Hemsworth was. Chris Hemsworth was the guy who dies at the beginning of Star Trek as
yeah,
James.
Because he had already done Cabin in the Woods by that time, but it wasn't out yet.
It wasn't out yet. And so that was kind of a, oh, could Chris Hemsworth be a thing? And honestly, Hemsworth really didn't become a leading man outside of Marvel until probably just a few years ago. I
don't even know that you could argue that still. I mean, I think he's great as Thor, but I don't know that you could. I don't know that anyone would still consider him a viable leading man, considering the way Men in Black went this.
That's fair.
Especially.
Because I guess I'm thinking about, like, I mean, I know, that's a fair point. I mean, I remember when Thor came out, it went
got Black Hat.
Yeah, you're bringing up some good points. I love Chris. Chris Hemsworth is good. I'm not a big fan of the Ghostbusters reboot, but I think I really like Chris Hemsworth in that movie. Yeah, I mean, he does Red Dawn, I think, in 2012. And that's again trying to be like a breakout film for him. I don't think nothing comes of that. I think also, and Chris Evans, like you said, wasn't a big lead guy. I mean, he was doing Fantastic Four. I think he's also in What's My Number, What's Your Number with Anna Faris, mm-hmm. that yeah. came out in 2011. He's doing some dramas. I can't remember. He'd done a movie called Puncture. He's not mainstream fully. So yeah, you're starting to see the groundwork of what Hollywood is going to become, I think, currently and currently is you're still seeing a few original films. Nostalgia is starting to take over with things like Planet of the Apes. I think even Super 8. Super 8 is just a great example of like nostalgia, a nostalgia film.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% think Super 8 paved the way for Stranger Things, like no hands.
Yeah,
like hands down. That I remember when that came out, and everyone was just like, "It's like a Spielberg movie, but it's not by Spielberg," and that has now become such a, you know, it's not even that noteworthy now that people are doing that as much.
No, not at all. It's like, oh, that's just that's the thing. So we're seeing a shift, and to kind of talk about a shift in the industry, I want to talk a little bit about Moneyball, which came out that year. And to go with the idea of genres being legitimized, Moneyball is a sports film, but it's a sports film that's written by Steve Zalian and then later rewritten by Aaron Sorkin. So it's Aaron Sorkin doing a sports film. And it's directed by Bennett Miller, who had done Capote, was the film he did before Moneyball. And then after that, he did Foxcatcher. So it's legitimizing the sports genre and making it more of just a drama. But in Moneyball, for those that haven't seen it, it's about, and I think it's also relevant because of Brad Pitt, it's about Billy Beane, who's the general manager of Oakland A's baseball team. It takes place in 2002. Billy Beane is about to lose all of his star players to major market teams. So he's about to lose Johnny Damon, who's about to go to the Red Sox. I think Jason Giambi, who's a pitcher, is about to go over to the Yankees. So you're, for those that are baseball fans, you're seeing all these big names leave this small market team and go to a big market. And they don't have any money. And Brad Pitt is supposed to create a team just like the year before, but with way less money and way less incentives to bring stars here. And so he does research and finds a way that there's kind of this new train of thought or new way of thought and new philosophy that's coming out in baseball that traditional baseball people are afraid of. And that's that you can essentially apply science to baseball that can help you determine wins. And he meets Jonah Hill, which is also, this is Jonah Hill's kind of first outing into a drama. And who would have thought that years later, I think he's more now of an indie darling and kind of prestige drama darling than probably a comedian, maybe. I don't know. So yeah, he meets up with Jonah Hill, and Jonah Hill's kind of this economics major who applies this philosophy, and Billy Beane and him, Brad Pitt, decide to create a team by taking players that are unwanted from other teams, but who have high on-base percentages. So basically, the more you get on base, the more runs you can get, the more wins you have. And so Moneyball's about that story. And so in this scene that we're going to show, it's Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill talking about what they want out of this. It's towards the end of the film, but Brad Pitt kind of explains what he wants out of all this.
And what's the point?
We just got the record.
Man, I've been doing this for... Listen, man. I've been in this game a long time. I'm not in it for a record, I'll tell you that. I'm not in it for a ring. It's when people get hurt. If we don't win the last game of the series, they'll dismiss us.
Bill.
I know these guys, I know the way they think, and they will erase us. And everything we've done here, none of it will matter. Any other team wins the World Series, good for them. They're drinking champagne, they get a ring. But if we win, on our budget with this team, we'll change the game. And that's what I want. I want it to mean something.
What? How do you feel about that clip from the...
I feel like around Oscar season, I saw enough clips of the two of them that, you know, it. I feel like I've seen some of it. And I know the kind of character that Jonah Hill plays, especially, which, like, everyone was so surprised by.
Yeah.
I feel like when it came out.
But it's a good transition for him because it's still in the movie. He's still a comedic role.
Yeah. But it seems kind of like quiet and reserved, which is,
yes,
which is different from the characters he had been playing for a while. And I think it just goes to show his range. Cause I mean, he followed that up with Wolf of Wall Street, which was a very, very different character. And I mean, if you need to see some Jonah Hill range, watch Maniac on Netflix. Cause it's incredible. Speaking of Emma Stone as well.
Yeah.
But, and Brad Pitt always. I watch Brad Pitt in anything.
And that so it's interesting when looking at, say, now in 2019, we're like, 2011's Brad Pitt's year. It might not seem like it now, but you have Moneyball and Tree of Life in the same year.
Yes.
And Tree of Life being one of Thomas's, probably one of your favorite films of all time. I don't want to speak for you.
Check my letterbox. It's up there. Actually, I don't know that it's in my top four on Letterboxd, because Days of Heaven, I think. I usually choose Days of Heaven over Tree of Life, but I do love Tree of Life.
But so yeah, it's really Brad Pitt's year. And what I find so funny nowadays, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood just came out not too long ago, for those that are listening that haven't seen it. But the big thing that everyone talks about is like, oh my God, Brad Pitt's really good. And I'm like, why are you just now finding this out? I feel like internet now, like people on the internet just, it's like with the Keanu Reeves stuff. It's like, they've been doing pretty much the same stuff for years, but all of a sudden people are catching on to like, I was listening to one podcast, a fairly like big podcast. And one of the podcasters was like, oh my God, when did Brad Pitt get hot? And I'm like,
what?
I'm like, what? I was like, where were you for the past 20 odd years?
Do you not remember? Do you not remember a Shania Twain song that? that's how I found out who Brad Pitt was when I was a kid. That Shania Twain song was like, "So you're Brad Pitt," and I remember being like, "Who's Brad Pitt?" And my mom being like, "A very handsome movie star," and I was like, "Okay, cool.
Okay." And yeah, I was just because there's a scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood where he takes off a shirt. They go, "Oh my God, he's really good looking." I'm like, "Yeah, like I don't know why you're surprised." Like, or like, "Oh my God, he's a really good actor." And when you get back to 2011, you're seeing Moneyball and Tree of Life, both very different performances. Moneyball is the more like leading charismatic leading man, and I think Tree of Life is. How do you explain his performance in Tree of Life?
Because I mean it's fantastic. It is, I think, one of the best depictions of like an abusive parent relationship. But you know the type of abuse, like 1950s abusive, like
yeah,
like you know, it's interesting. It's obviously a father who was too stern and had temper problems and masculinity issues and. Mm-hmm. But oh man, there's just this one scene where the son is like walking with Brad Pitt along the yard, and he just kind of, and he's just yelled at him and scared him, and he just kind of reaches out and like pulls him to his hip and just like pulls him close as they keep walking, and it is so well done. Oh man, love that movie. And the Criterion cut, the new cut, goes into like his childhood. Wow,
I haven't watched the new cut yet.
Yeah. Man, that's great.
But I think we're talking about Brad Pitt. I think it's a bit, what's happening in 2011 too, is that I think the star system is starting to falter. I think it's starting to be driven more by genre and tent poles. It's the beginnings of that. Like when you look at, again, the top movies, you don't, besides Moneyball and then Drive and Captain America, there's not many just say posters we're looking at Letterboxd of just one person's face. The poster is not trying to draw you into like Midnight in Paris. It's not like, oh, come watch an Owen Wilson movie. It establishes it's a fantasy just in the poster, it feels like. Girl with Dragon Tattoo is probably the only one that pops up where it's like, here's two people's face that you're coming to see for Daniel Craig, but no one really knows who Rooney Mara is at this point in time.
Yeah, I remember when they announced her, I was like,
who's that?
The girl from Social Network?
Yeah, the opening scene of Social Network.
I was like, she's gonna be Elizabeth Salander? That's a stretch.
But when you look at it, so you're the big faces you're popping out, I'm seeing Moneyball with Brad Pitt, I'm seeing Drive with Ryan Gosling, I'm seeing Mission Impossible 4 Ghost Protocol with Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
I'm seeing Melancholia with Kirsten Dunst, and then I'm seeing like Sherlock Holmes, Game of Shadows with Robert Downey Jr. and Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy with Gary Oldman. And that's kind of it, where it's like, here's the one person's face. Unless it's a Liam Neeson movie, that's all Liam Neeson's face. but yeah, I think you're starting to see the studios, the star system falter. A big example of that is Johnny Depp at this time in 2011. Johnny Depp has The Rum Diary, which if you forgot about that movie, it's totally fine. Everyone else did. And then you have Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, which is...
I also saw and totally forgot about. I can't tell you the plot of that whatsoever. Something about the Fountain of Youth.
Blackbeard, the Fountain of Youth. Penelope Cruz is in it.
Mermaids.
It's. But you're starting to see at that... Because I remember when it came out, everyone talked about how it did not do well at the U.S. box office. and it was like the lowest Pirates movie in terms of U.S. box office, but it was the largest box office for a Pirates movie internationally. Like, it made almost $1 billion. It was a $1 billion movie because it made like $700 to $800 million overseas.
Well, that makes sense. They always told us in TV when I was working in network TV and thought it was all miserable and you know, longed to work on a series that had a little bit of continuity and like continuing storylines and character arcs and things.
Yeah.
That doesn't play well overseas.
Yeah.
They want to go to a movie that where they don't, or they want to watch a show, and I'd assume go to a movie where they don't need to know what happened prior and can just sit down and watch. So that would make sense that like the one-off Pirates movie would do that. I want to rewind real quick to something, movie you touched on for a second, because I think if we're talking trends and we're talking setting up the decade, I think something big happened in 2011 that really changed the shape of blockbusters for the decade, or at least one blockbuster series. Ghost Protocol was a huge turn for the Mission Impossible franchise. And it's interesting in relationship to a movie that just came out, Hobbs and Shaw. I don't know if you saw one of the news articles related to that just started making the rounds was the contracts for Vin Diesel, Jason Statham, and The Rock just came out recently. And all three actors have stipulations in their contract about how little that basically their characters can't get beat up or lose a fight on screen. And I saw it on film Twitter. I saw a tweet that related that back to Tom Cruise. And their hypothesis was that the Mission Impossible franchise really took off in Ghost Protocol when they realized that Ethan should lose constantly and deadpan about it.
Yeah.
And you know, I love Mission Impossible 3. It's really good, but it's very dark and it's not fun per se. It is a engaging film and it's compelling, but it's not really fun. It's a little too, Philip Seymour Hoffman brings it a little too much in that one, I think. But Ghost Protocol was the one when it was really like, let's put Ethan in the craziest situations. Let's have everything go wrong. And let's just watch him roll with it. And that is what the franchise has become. I mean, Ghost Protocol was what really brought in the climbing the building and climbing the world's tallest building. And that was huge. And that's become their thing now, is how can they top climbing the world's tallest building?
And that's fair. I think, and I, even though Mission Impossible was always a team ensemble movie, for some reason it felt like Ghost Protocol was the one that really leaned into it the most. Where it's like, you finally have Simon Pegg, who was like a kind of like a cameo role in Mission Impossible 3, is like a legit member of the team. They've added Jeremy Renner, who's also at this moment in time people are seeing as like the next A-list guy, which doesn't fully happen, honestly. Like, he's a recognizable name and is a big name, but like Jeremy Renner's not really the guy carrying a movie by himself nowadays. I think he's actually a really great supporting actor. And he's done some good roles, but like, because you have this and you have Bourne Legacy, which I think is the next year, I believe, in 2012. And they're trying to make him the big thing, but they're at least putting him a part of the team. And I think is it Paula Patton who's also in Mission Impossible 4? Let me see. I want to make sure this works.
Yeah,
Paula Patton. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the team members are Tom Cruise, Jeremy Renner, Simon Pegg, Paula Patton. And if you go to Wikipedia, like one of the posters is all four of them together. So it feels like even in the marketing, it's trying to make it more, it's the team aspect. But it's a good point you're bringing up that Mission Impossible shifted. I think another example of that, you brought up Hobbs and Shaw. I think Fast Five is another example that decides to transition to something else. Because Fast Five is when it becomes a completely different type franchise. 1, 2, and 3, and 4 are kind of, it's just fast cars. It's like a car culture. 5 is when it somehow becomes a heist film. And then from then on out, it's about kind of the same thing you're talking about with Mission Impossible, trying to top the last thing. Fast Five becomes, okay, we do these massive stunts in different countries. Now in four, now in six, we have to top that, and then seven, we have to top that, and then eight. So that's what's becoming so ridiculous.
I was just talking about that yesterday when we were talking about Hobbs and Shaw. I was like, I've seen the first three Fast and Furious movies. You know that.
Yeah.
That's all I've seen. And when these trailers are out and they're like, the United Nations called us and they need us to fly a car into space and save a satellite. And I'm like, weren't these guys just boosting PlayStation 2s out of the back of a truck?
Yeah.
Like, what? How?
Why? That's why you need to watch Fast 5. Because that's where the shift happens. That's honestly, like, we just watched it last night, and I haven't seen it since it came out. And it's literally the rise of The Rock. Like, you're literally, like, you're seeing him. In 2010, we talked about it in our last episode, he did Tooth Fairy. He goes from Tooth Fairy to being essentially the main antagonist of Fast 5. And I think he steals every scene he's in Fast 5. And he loses fights in Fast 5, by the way. Because he's just not the star that he currently is. Mm-hmm. He's still, like, a supporting role. But he's a charismatic supporting actor who's able to break through because of this franchise. But it becomes the Fast 5, for those that haven't seen it, like Thomas... they're still just stealing cars. They wind up in Brazil. They're stealing cars. What happens is they get they've broken Vin Diesel out of jail. They're stealing a car, and some DEA agents wind up dead, and they're blamed for it. And so Hobbs, who's a bounty hunter, because they apparently killed so many agents, Hobbs, The Rock's character, is after them. And so that's Hall of Fast 5. And then somehow it becomes, I think, 6 is, hey, we need y'all's help. The government needs y'all's help. So that's what happens in the 6th one. And then it just becomes even bigger. So by the time, like now, it ends up becoming like a spy genre movie in a weird way. And it was never like that.
Yeah, they don't even drive cars anymore. They've got tanks. Well,
there's a few scenes where you gotta have, like, yeah, but like, I think Fast 8 is when it's a submarine, is what it is. Fast 7 is like they're jumping from skyscraper to skyscraper. Fast 6 is I think the airplane. But Fast 4 and Fast, I'm sorry, I'm just gonna, I'm not even a big Fast and the Furious fan, but I'm a big Rock fan. But also to bring it more into context, Fast and Furious 4 and mainly Fast 5 is what introduces people to Gal Gadot, because that's her first big role, is in the Fast and the Furious franchise. And she's, I think, part of the villains team in the 4th one, and then becomes part of the main team in Fast 5. And that's what pushes her to a more mainstream audience.
We've talked about a couple of actors that have kind of come up in conversation that we're talking about, like, the rise of these actors.
Yeah.
But you and I laid out a couple as we were researching. We had a couple other ones that we picked out. So let's transition onto that. So going off of what we talked about, 2010...
Yeah.
You get the rise of Emma Stone.
Yeah.
2011, you get a partnership that has become, I want to say, a little iconic.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like within the decade, I think, of like young, attractive, talented actors, you got Cooper and Lawrence.
Yeah.
And you got Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
Which all started back with 2011's Crazy Stupid Love.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of my favorite, probably my favorite rom-com of the modern era.
Yeah.
Gotta say.
It's very, because, so back in the day, in the 30s and 40s, it was easier to put two actors together and make that a thing, because they were all under studio contracts. So they were like, okay, we're going to put Hepburn and Spencer Tracy together. Bam, that's a pair. Myrna Loy, William Powell, yeah, that's a pair. I don't know if studios can fully think that now, because actors have more power in what roles they do. So it's always interesting to see actors doing multiple movies together, but not in just like a support, like an ensemble, but also as like a pair. Like, hey, it's going to be Gosling and Emma Stone, and they've done 3 movies together, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Cooper and Lawrence have done 4 movies together.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a rarity nowadays, but Crazy Stupid Love, I think, why, because they're so good together in this movie, is what has allowed them to continue to make films together. So yeah, speaking of that, we do have a clip from Crazy Stupid Love. And it's, I think it's the first meeting, or give us a breakdown of Crazy Stupid Love first before we show the clip, because since it's one of your favorites.
I love this movie. So Crazy Stupid Love is, it's like a two-hander. It's telling two very different types of love stories. One is about Steve Carell as a kind of a suburban working dad who finds out that his wife has been cheating on him and wants a divorce. Yeah. And they've been married since high school. He's never really dated anyone. She was his first girlfriend. And it's kind of about him trying to enter the world of dating, where he meets Ryan Gosling, who's a ladies' man, and Ryan Gosling kind of takes him under his wing and teaches him how to date in the modern era. At the same time, we meet Emma Stone, who is a young woman who is graduating law school and yes. kind of has her whole life planned out, has a safe boyfriend, and all of a sudden kind of meets Ryan Gosling separate of his Steve Carell storyline, and the two of them strike up a relationship where it's really outside both of their norms. He's not used to being in any sort of stable relationship, and she's breaking outside of her plans for the rest of her life.
Hi. Who looks like a carrot?
Conan O'Brien. My friend Hannah here thinks he's sexy.
That's weird, because I think that your friend Hannah is really sexy.
Oh my God. You did not just say that. How old are you?
What are you, a lawyer?
A little bit.
Come on.
I know.
You are? Is she?
Gonna be. Don't you think you're a little old to be using cheesy pickup lines?
Objection. Leading the witness. Wow, Hannah, you're really wearing that dress. Like you're doing it a favor.
Oh God.
That's a line. Me sitting over there for the past 2 hours not being able to take my eyes off of you is a fact. I mean, there's lots of beautiful women in this bar, your friend included. Hi.
I love you.
But I can't take my eyes off of you. That's a fact. It's not a lie. I find you very attractive. Do you find me attractive?
She does.
I don't.
You do. She does.
Yes, she does.
I don't.
You do.
You do.
I don't.
Hannah, can I buy you a drink?
No.
You say no a lot, don't you?
No.
Oh, boy. Permission to approach the bench?
Seriously?
Just come on. Let me deliver my closing argument.
Sure. Proceed.
Hannah. We live in a physical world, right?
Uh-huh.
And you're going to age, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee you this, you're never going to regret going home with that guy from the bar that one time that was a total tomcat in the sack. But I can't guarantee that you won't not regret it.
That's a double negative.
You're a double negative. Okay, Hannah, can I buy you a drink?
Okay. You know what? It's time to go home.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, it's forward of you, but okay.
Yeah.
I'll do it.
A T-Bone saw three.
So, should I get my car or yours? Should I pull the car around? Have you been drinking? I'll drive.
So good.
I feel like 2011 might be peak Ryan Gosling. I know that's that might be like underselling what he did afterwards, but with this movie and Drive and even Ides of March, I think he's good in. Like,
I think... When you look back at it, I think his legacy is going to be Drive.
Yeah.
Just because he's played. When people talk about Ryan Gosling, when you kind of make fun of Ryan Gosling, you know, if you're doing the SNL sketch of Ryan Gosling, somebody plays a character like Drive. Everybody's like, oh, he's always in these movies. He doesn't talk. He's real quiet. But I mean, that was a screwball comedy scene. Like, his timing is fantastic in that. So I think it's really interesting that you've got the 1-2 punch in 2011 of him barely speaking in Drive,
yeah,
and nailing it, and then, you know, going, being able to go toe for toe with comedic timing with Steve Carell and Emma Stone in a movie like this, I think really shows that he's a lot more flexible than people sometimes give him credit for, I think.
Yeah. And the year before this he did a Blue Valentine as well. And so he's doing so many different things in this time period. And I feel like now, like I said, he's not really known as much for those type films.
This isn't really a rise of anyone, but while we're talking about kind of the duality of Ryan Gosling and in 2011. Someone else who I think is kind of given a hard time for only playing himself, even though he's recognized as a great actor, is George Clooney.
Yeah.
And in 2011, he had The Ides of March and Descendants. And I was trying to find a Descendants clip for this episode. I couldn't really find the one that I wanted online, but I love that movie so much. And when I was just going back and watching clips, that is a completely different George Clooney.
Yeah.
Than you see, than what people say that he plays in every movie. He's not slick. If you watch him, he's a little overweight. His hair is like always mussed up, and he's just wild eyed. And that if anyone hasn't seen it, that basically boils down to he's a father of two. His wife is in a coma. They're trying to decide whether or not to remove life support, and at the same time, he finds out that she's been cheating on him and was planning on leaving him. And he's just in over his head with his daughters. He's in over his head with trying to figure out what to do with his wife. And it's all kind of played for comedic purposes because it's Alexander Payne, and he mines really dark stuff for comedy. But oh man, Clooney plays it so well, and it's so far from it's a lot closer as far as his performances go. It's a lot closer to something like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where yeah. he's playing someone who's like that kind of manic energy he can bring yeah. To film sometime.
It feels like it's his most one of his more everyman characters in a way.
For sure. I mean, even down to like the shirts they put him in, he's always wearing these like Hawaiian shirts that are too big for him, and like cargo shorts and flip-flops.
He's always sweating, it feels like. Like, mm-hmm. he always had, yeah. But see, another thing, I don't know if you mentioned, but it's like, it takes place in Hawaii. And mm-hmm. so it's very interesting seeing kind of, and this is just Payne, but also the other writers, they did The Way, Way Back. It was, mm-hmm. It was a Jim Rash and,
Nat Faxon.
Yeah. They were also the writers on it. But, the other conflict that he has, so it's in Hawaii, and his family owns the last piece of like untouched land in Hawaii or whatever, and all of his family wants him to sell it so the people can build a condo or build a whole resort on it, and the whole family wants to make money. And Clooney mm-hmm. has that stress on him, like the more like that's more of the big external conflict, and then the stuff that's more interesting though is the personal conflict of my wife has been cheating on me, and I'm finding out, but she's in a coma, and I can't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And it's also Shailene Woodley's kind of breakout movie as well, because she was just doing an ABC Family show at that time, and Descendants was her. That was like her film breakout. And mm-hmm. then now she went back to TV recently with Big Little Lies.
It's not TV; it's HBO.
That's fair. Okay. but yeah, it's like, I remember when Descendants came out, and I was like, oh, this is that girl from, like, was it Diary of an American Teenager or whatever?
Secret Life of the American Teenager.
Thank you. Okay. Diary of an American Teenager is a very different movie. or Teenage Girl is what it is. So Secret Life of an American Teenager. Yeah, it's, and I was just like, that doesn't make any sense. But yeah, you're seeing some of these younger actors be on the rise, and Descendants is one that I feel like people forget about from that year. Because mm-hmm. we're talking about genre and how genre has been put to the forefront of 2011, and I think is the most remembered. And you look back at the dramas of that year, they're not as talked about. So you have things like The Descendants, and honestly, you have things like The Artist that have been kind of not forgotten, but just...
I think The Artist is only talked about in conversations where people talk about how it shouldn't have won Best Picture.
Yeah. I mean, it's just... So it's a very just... It's a very different time where those films are just kind of being forgotten. What's also interesting too, War Horse is another example. That was a Spielberg epic in World War I. And even though I like that movie, most people I know don't talk about it or don't even like it. And when you look at kind of the contemporary reviews for that time, they're calling it one of the best films of the year. And it just hasn't held over in terms of cultural significance since it came out.
It feels weird to say about a movie about World War I, but maybe it was a little ahead of its time because everybody's doing World War I movies now.
Or World War I, World War II. Yeah, it's...
I mean, you got Nolan's 2 years ago. We just had the trailer come out for Sam Mendes's coming up. It feels like maybe War Horse was just a little too early.
to World War movies were just too early. Maybe it was. And I think Spielberg does a good job with it. I know I find myself defending it so much. But it's a children's book. He adapted a children's book, and your protagonist... Have you seen War Horse, by the way?
Yeah, I was very impressed by it.
It's like it's a very interesting structure for Spielberg, because he's literally, his protagonist is a horse. And somehow, in a way, you could argue it's a road trip movie, because he's basically trying to get back to his original owner, and the original owner is trying to get back to him. And he meets all these different characters along the way and affects their lives.
You got a lot of big directors doing kind of like kids and family movies that year. Because Spielberg did that and Tintin.
Came out the same day, by the way. I remember when that happened. War Horse and Tintin both came out Christmas Day of 2011.
Wow. Which... And then you've got Scorsese doing Hugo. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even so far as you've got Cameron Crowe doing We Bought a Zoo, which is a little more adult aimed, but definitely like his most family friendly of his films, I think.
I would agree with that. And I think even you're seeing, Midnight in Paris is one of his more Woody Allen's more accessible films. But yeah, you're starting to see, and Hugo, I think, is a masterpiece. Like, I love Hugo. And that's one, again, not as talked about, but still very popular with people from that year. And some people might argue it was one of the, it deserved a Best Picture more than The Artist did.
Well, I think it Hugo, I think back to Hugo when people are kind of having some doubts about Scorsese working with all this technology for The Irishman, because I think back to Hugo, and Hugo was the first movie I saw in theaters in 3D that I thought people can do something really interesting with 3D if they really try to.
I agree with that.
And I don't know that 3D has, I don't think 3D has advanced in the ways that people thought it was going to. I think it kind of showed itself as a bit of a fad. I mean, it's still out there, but people aren't really trying to do fun things with it. But Hugo was the movie where I said, oh, okay, maybe this could be interesting if directors really shoot for 3D.
And not just converting it in post.
Mm-hmm. Because that like opening shot going through the train station, I was like, this shot was made to be 3D.
Yeah, I actually saw that in theaters in 3D. And it was one of the few, films that, because I was very like protest against 3D. Because I was a young film student who thought he knew everything, and he was like, 3D's ruining it. And I sought out Hugo in 3D, and I remember it was just me and two other people in the theater to watch Hugo, and they didn't turn on the 3D at first.
Oh no!
And I was just like, I remember walked out. I go, I think my glasses aren't working, and because it was my second. I literally saw Avatar in 3D, and then maybe the next thing I saw in 3D was Hugo a year later. And I remember just like, yo, these glasses aren't working. And I was like, I walked out and handed it to them. Oh, well, here's another pair. And I walked back in. I was like, no, these still aren't working. And they go, oh, we forgot to turn the 3D on. I'm like, what place is this? Like,
can we start it over, please? The establishing shot.
They had to start it over because... Yeah, there you go. And the two other people, the two people in the theater were just going to be like, we're just going to watch it that way. And I'm like, oh, this is insane. But yeah, so you're seeing these older directors kind of dabble in kids' films. And what's funny is that the next thing Scorsese makes is Wolf of Wall Street in 2013, vastly different 2 years later.
All right, I want to go back real quick because I think the biggest rise... possibly even bigger than Gosling of 2011, because Gosling was around.
He was around. Like
we knew who Ryan Gosling was.
Yeah.
But 2011 rolls up, and all of a sudden, just bam. I just remember, before I reveal who it was, I remember distinctly the first movie I saw this actress in. And I just, I mean, I came out of the movie blown away, as I've already said on this episode.
Yeah.
But the thing I came out of Tree of Life saying was, oh my God, who was that woman playing the mother? She was incredible.
Yeah.
She's fantastic in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually never seen The Help. The Help was a huge, huge cultural thing for a minute there. Everybody I know read the book and saw the movie, and I somehow missed it. But I just actually last weekend watched Take Shelter. So she had three really like impactful roles just out of nowhere. And I've read an interview with her recently where she was talking about getting Tree of Life, because I think it was the first to shoot out of these three. And she was just like, I was a nobody. I had barely any credits to my name, and all of a sudden I'm playing against Brad Pitt in a Terrence Malick movie. And it was Terrence Malick's first movie in like 10 years. And it's just like, boom, here she is. Here's Jessica Chastain. And I mean, what a year.
Yeah. I mean, talk about a breakout year. I mean, Tree of Life, The Help, Take Shelter, three vastly different movies. She's playing a different character in each one. And each one is just very complex in some way. I remember, because when I saw Tree of Life, this is a very weird thing that I remember, but I remember thinking, I realized just how much people can say without talking.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, I remember there's a scene when, again, Brad Pitt and Jessica Chastain are walking down the road, and Brad Pitt kind of reaches out to her to touch her back, and she just like kind of quivers and like gets away from him and cringes. Mm-hmm. And it's just very subtle, but I was just like, oh, so much was said in that one moment. And so the first time I saw her was The Debt. And The Debt was that thriller that she plays a young Helen Mirren.
Mm-hmm.
Is what
I
it did. Is.
I saw that, but I think after some of these other
yeah, and I saw it and they said, "Oh, that." I was like, "That I don't know who that is," but that was she was good. And then I think it was I think I saw Take Shelter on video, because this is still when video stores are around in certain cities and everywhere. It's they're on the downward spiral. But I think I ran Take Shelter. But that was the first Jeff Nichols movie I watched. And honestly, first Terrence Malick film I probably saw as well at that point. But yeah, I think she's phenomenal in The Help. I think she's great in Tree of Life and then Take Shelter. And so we have a clip from Take Shelter since Thomas recently watched it, and kind of showcasing just a scene with Jessica Chastain and Michael Shannon, who I think is also probably on the rise as well. I think he did Revolutionary Road in 2009, and that was kind of his big breakout film. But now he's starting to pick up more prestige roles in this era. So can you tell us a little bit about Take Shelter and then the scene as well?
Yeah. So, Take Shelter is it's set in the South, in a small town in the South. And Michael Shannon, plays a character whose, mother is, lives in a, assisted living home, after having, been diagnosed with schizophrenia many years ago. And during the film, he starts to experience symptoms of schizophrenia. He starts to have nightmares that a storm is coming, that this giant storm is coming, like a supernatural storm that's going to turn everyone into like these zombie-like creatures almost. And takes that paranoia and starts to build a tornado shelter in the backyard, and ends up ruining his career, putting his family's savings at stake at a time when his daughter really needs some surgery. And really driving his wife away, and all because this is something kind of, we've talked about Southern films on this podcast before, but there's something very Southern about this kind of he's terrified to admit, even though his mom is diagnosed with schizophrenia, it's an open secret, but he's terrified to admit that he might be struggling with mental illness, because it's just not something that people in the South talk about, especially not men. And so even though he knows that this is probably schizophrenia presenting itself, he just falls deeper and deeper into this paranoia. And so this scene is after his wife, played by Jessica Chastain, has discovered that he has not only blown all their money on expanding their tornado shelter, but has also stolen equipment from work in order to build it.
Not a word. You didn't say one word about this to me. Don't you think you owe me that? Don't you think that you might respect me enough to at least consider what I'd have to say?
And I didn't want you worrying about it.
Well, I'm worried, Curtis. How are you paying for all that?
I got a home improvement loan from the bank.
that without talking to me. You know the expenses we have coming up. You want to waste money on a stupid tornado shelter?
I'm doing it. I'm doing it for us. I know you don't understand.
You're right. I don't understand. I don't understand half the stuff you've been doing lately. I don't understand you putting Red out back. I don't understand you staying up all night in that stupid tornado shelter. You don't come to bed half the time. You leave. You don't tell me where you're going. Explain that to me. Please. Tell me something that helps me understand why you're being like this.
There's nothing to explain.
All right, Brandon, I've got a game.
Okay, you got a game?
Got a game for you. Since we've just talked about everyone who was on the rise in 2011, I'm going to give you three people who had bad years in 2011.
Okay.
And I want you to rank how well their careers have survived.
Okay.
These bad years. All right. First off, you've got Ryan Reynolds.
Okay.
Green Lantern and The Change-Up.
Oh, yeah.
Both critical failures, box office failures. Next up, Justin Timberlake.
Ooh.
In Time. Ooh. In Time and Friends with Benefits. In Time, huge box office failure. Friends with Benefits, decent.
I think it made a good bit of money. It was a mid-budget film, mid-budget comedy with two very hot people in terms of popularity and also just hot, attractive people. In a movie together. So yeah.
David Gordon Green.
Ooh.
With Your Highness. And then a film which was probably never meant to be seen, The Sitter, which had been shot years earlier and had just been shelved, but once Jonah Hill got an Oscar nomination, it was released. So those are your three.
Are we judging just acting?
No. You're not judging necessarily the year. You're judging what their careers have done afterwards.
I mean, just film careers, or are we talking about overall careers? Because
overall careers.
That throws a loop. Okay, that makes it hard.
Let's do film. If you're going to talk, we'll take Timberlake's musical career out of it.
Yeah, I don't. I think Timberlake's number three.
I agree. I don't think his acting career has really bounced back.
That was a rough year, because then he does Runner a few years later, and that's
he was really high. I mean, he was coming off of Social Network. It was the time to really make or break, and
his best film, because it's a great film, but his probably only shining star in terms of critical acclaim post this year is Inside Llewyn Davis. In terms of money, Trolls. I think he had a more interesting career pre 2011. I think he's good in Black Snake Moan. I think he's phenomenal in Social Network. He also has Bad Teacher as well, by the way, in 2011.
Oh yeah! Wow, look at that. Three bad ones.
Well, Bad Teacher made money.
I saw that in theaters.
I think with In Time, Friends with Benefits, and Bad Teacher, I think that's Timberlake trying to find a foothold in film. So you're seeing a two rom-coms and a sci-fi action movie, and he's the leading man in all three. And I think Timberlake can be good in supporting roles, but they pushed him too quickly. He's number one, number two on the call sheet in three movies in one year when he hadn't even led. I think his biggest film as a lead was The Open Road with Jeff Bridges, which I've not seen.
I have that on DVD. I've never watched it. Picked it up at a Blockbuster.
He's kind of in supporting roles. So I think number three is Timberlake. Number two is David Gordon Green. Even though he's had hits with TV stuff not TV, but HBO stuff with Vice Principals, but also TV with Red Oaks. He's directed such films as Halloween and Stronger, but he's had a few kind of missteps along the way post 2011 with like Our Brand is Crisis. He also did, there was something else he did. One second. It was, well, he did Prince Avalanche, which I think didn't make money, but it was like, it was critically acclaimed. Maglehorn, I never saw with Al Pacino. Joe, I think is a really great, or a really good, film he made. So I think number two is David Gordon Green. I'll be interested to see what Halloween does for him, because if he's doing all three Halloween movies, he's basically transitioned from a comedy drama director. He's an interesting guy in terms of directing in general. He does comedy, like really off the wall, almost stoner comedies to like Southern dramas, and now he's delving into TV shows and horror films. So I think he's number two, and then I think Ryan Reynolds is number one. I think Reynolds is talk. I mean, one of the great. I mean, I know people don't like using the word comeback, and Reynolds is always working throughout the time, but to go for, like
2011 should have been a career killer for him.
That should have been, yeah. And then he does R.I.P.D. I think a year later or whatever. Like, when was R.I.P.D.? Was that? I'm looking at that. Was that 2010 or was that before then? I'm gonna see. I'm gonna check. That's 2013. So if you do 2011 Green Lantern and your next big budget film is R.I.P.D. in 2013, which is also a critical and commercial failure, you probably shouldn't have a career in terms of big studio films after that. And somehow Ryan Reynolds was able to resurrect himself into a movie star. And probably one of the top movie stars in the game with Deadpool. Yep. Because he is one of those few superheroes, in my opinion, the superhero franchise, that if you take him out of that character, then you have no movie. Like, I think Downey's that was the same way with Iron Man. And maybe you could argue Chris Pratt as Star-Lord. And then maybe Scarlett Johansson as Black Widow. But, like, I think Ryan Reynolds is the, him and Downey are the big ones where you're like, if you take them out of that character, you don't have a movie.
I think that works out.
Would you do the same?
I think I'd put the same. Yeah. Okay. I mean, David Gordon Green has obviously continued to do well, but I don't think he is a household name. And anytime I try to have an argument with people that he should be considered an auteur, Your Highness is what people point to.
Yeah.
And usually the people pointing to Your Highness don't even realize that he did The Sitter.
Yeah. Because I've seen The Sitter. I've not seen Your Highness.
But yeah, it's just insane that Reynolds survived this year. But it's not until I looked over this list that I even realized just kind of how screwed Timberlake was after
Social Network.
You can see the studios going. I mean, this is how it works in casting. Everyone go the weekend Social Network comes out, everyone goes to see it, and then they immediately show up to the office on Monday and say, "We got Justin Timberlake's agent."
Yeah,
and that's just how it works sometimes, and it doesn't always pan out after that.
No, it sadly doesn't. And I think, but then after that, I think that's when he started pivoting back to music. Was after 2011. Because
that's also what you're seeing, you know, that exact same phenomenon is how, like we said with Ryan Reynolds, Blue Valentine. Everyone came out of Gosling, Blue Valentine. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Ryan Gosling. Everyone came out of Blue Valentine and said, "Get me Ryan Gosling on the phone," and that's why you've got him in three movies this year.
Yeah. And like we talked about this on the Road Trip podcast, how like, and I think even this is true probably nowadays, but when we're talking about the 70s of how the studios are always like they're about 18 months behind. That's how long, like, with prep, production, development prep, production, post, will take for a film to get made. And so, like, 18 months after Social Network comes out or whatever, and you probably had stuff in the pipeline with Timberlake, but it's, like, it starts to kind of, it falters. But it's, like, you kind of have two opposite things. Like, look at Timberlake and Gosling. Both have three films the same year. They both kind of had a breakout dramatic role the year before with Blue Valentine with Gosling and Timberlake with Social Network, and both just have two completely different career paths after that. Timberlake tries to go more comedic route and it kind of fails for him. He does his one action film, Within Time, also fails for him. And then Gosling does the Crazy Stupid Love, success, Drive success. And Ides of March is, I think, critically successful at that point. I don't know how well it holds up nowadays. So I just watched it for the first time and wasn't a big fan. But it has a great cast. Some awards we would give out for this year. We've kind of talked about a few of these. But also a few people were on the rise that year. You have McConaissance beginning to start with Lincoln Lawyer and Bernie. You're having the rise of Melissa McCarthy with Bridesmaids, which I think was just a... And a way you could argue that was a rise for even Kristen Wiig and all of the people in that cast with Bridesmaids.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have Michael Fassbender on the rise with Shame and X-Men. You're seeing a lot of people that are very relevant today are starting to get their climb the ladder in 2011. Thomas, to you. We're going to do a few kind of games or things since then. But what is, since we talked to a lot of these actors, who's the breakout of the year to you?
I got to give it to Chastain. She was the one who really felt like she exploded onto the scene out of nowhere and just blew me away immediately, and then followed it up with Zero Dark Thirty
the next year
and just cemented herself. I think of everyone here, you're not going to see anyone else who became a household name as quickly as she did.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think in comparison to, say, Emma Stone the year before, mm-hmm. where they just all of a sudden become, oh, I know, who is that person? And Jennifer Lawrence as well.
Even with Emma Stone and Jennifer Lawrence, you still kind of had them around.
Yeah.
Before that real breakout. And
this is like legit, like I made three great movies. And now everyone loves like once they're in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with you on breakout. I'm a little biased. I'm going to say The Rock is a good breakout of the year in terms of like looking at what our industry currently is, because currently we don't have many movie star like international movie stars, in America. And most of it's based on franchises and IP. And granted, he is in IP movies, but he's still like a sought after leading man who's developed a brand overseas. So I think you could argue that you're starting to see a breakout that doesn't fully take hold till a few years later. Most underrated film of the year.
Ooh, let me scan the list real quick. Let's edit some of this out. I think there's definitely a cult following for this movie, but I don't know that it's like a household. You know, I don't think it's a huge movie, but yeah. I feel weird calling it underrated because I've never talked to anyone who said they didn't like it, but I think the movie out of this list from 2011 that I revisit the most often,
mm-hmm.
is Cabin in the Woods.
Okay.
Love that movie. It is so much fun. It really kind of brings this energy to a horror film that I don't think I had seen in a horror film since like the first Scream. Like meta horror nerd, you know, that just really in a really smart way acknowledges that you're working within this genre that has so many tropes and says, hey, everybody out there, I know you guys love horror movies. I know you love these tropes.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have some fun with it.
Okay.
And that I think is one that I continue to almost every Halloween, I'll pull that movie back out.
Okay.
And watch it. And I don't know that it gets enough credit from people who didn't see it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't want to call it underrated because it's not one that people go, oh, that wasn't that good, because everybody who's seen it loves it. But
okay, fair. I have not revisited that movie since it came out. This one's a tough one for me because I have like three movies I could say for this.
Wait, I want to change my answer. Okay, never mind, you go.
What were you going to change it to?
Oh, man. I love Rango. I love Rango so much.
Okay.
I think Rango is fantastic. I'm not changing it. That's just a dual answer. I love Westerns, and I love Rango.
I think, I enjoy Rango a lot. I saw it in theaters. I remember watching that. Let me tell you. Okay. I don't want to say all three of them because that's just cheating.
I mean, I did two, so we'll give you two.
Okay, I'll do two. I'm gonna go with Attack the Block as an underrated movie. I think that's more like, I think it's really great. I think that's Boyega's like kind of first film, Juan Boyega's first film. I love the style of it. I find it just fun. I think it's a fun alien movie that, like, I don't know. I've seen it one time, but anytime someone asks me for like a crazy movie,
it gives you a genre you're familiar with from a point of view you would never imagine.
Yeah, I just think there's texture to it, there's comedy in it, there's action, there's sci-fi. Like, I really, that's one because we do midnight movies here in LA, and that's one I've always kind of wanted to do because it just screams midnight movie to me.
Yeah.
Because it's fun. It's just, in some cases, silly in a few things. It's just, it's so stylized. I love it. I really do love it. And the next one, I'm going to see how this one goes over with people. I'm going to say The Gray with Liam Neeson.
I've never seen it, but it does kind of have that cult status. I think also aided by Key and Peele.
I don't know about this.
I mean, they do all they used to do that sketch where the two like valets so into Liam Neeson's. But anyone I know who's seen it, I think is kind of like low key obsessed with it.
When I watched it because I wasn't expecting much, and I remember when it came out, it was like, it's in the middle of that Liam Neeson craze, okay, so you're getting Taken's already happened.
I saw Unknown that year, and I can't remember anything about it whatsoever.
Same, exactly. Yeah, Unknown comes out, I think you have Walk Among the Tombstones, I think 2000, a few years later. You get like Nonstop. It becomes like Liam Neeson fighting something or fighting someone on something. It's like Nonstop. Liam Neeson fighting someone on the airplane. What was it? The Commuter.
The Commuter.
Liam Neeson on a train. Like The Gray, and The Gray was kind of pitched as Liam Neeson fighting wolves. And it's just so much more than that. Like, I don't know how to express how much that movie is just like, it's almost like a horror film in a weird way, but it's a survival film. It's like essentially this oil drilling team is like they crash land in Alaska and wolves just start hunting them, and it's just like, it's so intense, and there's more message behind it than I think any of Neeson's action films. Joe Carnahan, who can be hit or miss sometimes. The year before he did A-Team, which didn't go over that well, but I think The Gray is just a film that needs to be looked at by some people, especially if you're a Neeson fan. That's my two. Most overrated of the year.
Overrated of the year. Interesting. I'm gonna go with, and this is a little uneducated because I haven't seen the rest of the movies, but to prepare for this film, I've never seen any of the modern Planet of the Apes movies, and to prepare for this episode, I watched Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which is the first of the like modern Planet of the Apes trilogy, and I wasn't blown away, and I understand that the second one is supposed to be incredible and kind of the trilogy is built off of the second one, but it's developed I think because the second one is so good, people have built up this mythology around that trilogy that like, oh my gosh, they're so good, like you have to see them. And the first one was the motion capture performance was great, but other than that, the pacing was really weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like nothing happens. And then the last like 10 minutes,
something happens.
Apes just like take over the entire city of San Francisco. Like they break out of their they break out of their like shelter, animal shelter, and then all of a sudden they are literally controlling the streets of the city, and it's weird. It's weird pacing. But yeah, maybe I'll see the second one and it'll completely change my mind. I'm looking forward to seeing the second one because I understand that that's the one. The third one's supposed to be good, but the second one is like, wow.
Yeah, but, that's I haven't seen any of them, by the way, and that's what I hear as well.
Mm-hmm.
Oh God, what's my overrated? This is actually a very tough one for me. Because the one I want to say.
Say it.
I feel like will hurt people.
Do it. Hurt them.
I think Bridesmaids is kind of overrated.
Ooh. Nope. Yeah. No, you shouldn't have said that, Danny.
I will say this. I've watched it twice, and each time it's gotten better. It's gotten.
Oh, yeah. Twice is not enough. Twice is not enough for Bridesmaids, man.
It got better the last time I saw it. The first time I saw it, I think I was just so, like, everyone's like, yo, it's like the female Hangover. And I don't see it as that. I feel like I feel like people misread some films sometimes and try to pitch it as one thing when it's something way more than that.
I would rather watch Bridesmaids than The Hangover for any day.
Okay. I might need to revisit both of them because I haven't revisited. I haven't seen Hangover since theaters.
I don't know. I've always been a huge Kristen Wiig fan, and her like style of like the jokes in that movie just get me.
They're I people are gonna hate me for it. I know. That was one I need to revisit. I understand that, and it's gotten better when I've watched it. I think it was more, maybe just too much was put on to that movie, if that makes sense. Like, too much cult, like, again, it was this is the female Hangover. This is, like, the most important film of the year. But I think it was a big breakout for, I think, female comedies, though. And I think with, again, a lot of those actresses, it broke them out. And I'm very happy for that. And a lot of those actresses, I love. Rose Byrne, well, I think love.
It had a huge cultural impact.
Yeah.
In that it showed everyone, you know, there's every once in a while a film will come along and will show studio, because studios are so you know, they will not change their ways unless they are shown that there's a profit to changing their ways.
I agree with that.
And every once in a while a movie will come along like Bridesmaids, like Black Panther, and there's always going to be, like, you know, there's always going to be claims of it being overrated, and it is. There is going to be like overhyping because sometimes people equate the business ramifications with the like actual ramifications of the film. But you know, this was the movie that came along and said, hey, yes, Hangover came along and said, hey, you can do a fairly cheap comedy with unknown actors and it can be huge.
Yeah.
And then Bridesmaids came along and said pretty much the same thing, but with women, which was an even bigger revelation at the time.
I agree with that.
To the studio and led to, for better or for worse, a lot of comedy films that tried to replicate that.
Yeah. I will say that the hype train kind of killed me, is what it was. Because I didn't see it till video. I didn't see it in theater. So I see it like 6 months after it came out. And yeah, that's, again, twice in 8 years, it deserves a rewatch. I'll agree with that. Biggest disappointment of the year to you?
Probably J. Edgar.
Okay.
I was really excited for that one. I mean, Eastwood, this was before Eastwood had kind of developed his current reputation for just like churning out somewhat subpar movies.
Bad movies.
Sorry, Clint. Yeah. But
he's a big listener of the show.
I mean, DiCaprio, Army Hammer following up on the Social Network.
Yeah.
You know, this big historical drama, and I saw it and remember like next to nothing about it. I remember apparently Adam Driver was in it. I don't even remember that. I'm looking at the list right now.
Yeah, I don't remember that one at all. I saw it, I rented it, and I can't remember it. For me, biggest disappointment of that year for me was Scream 4. Dear God. I became a big Scream fan when I was in college or high school into college, and I was so stoked for Scream 4, and I've never been more let down probably by a movie than Scream 4. It was good to see them all back together, but like the purpose of a franchise, like to restart a franchise, it made no damn sense by the end of it. Because spoiler alert, they like kill all the new characters they added in, and you're like, wait, so why are we here? Like it's for a new generation of Scream, and then it transitioned in the TV later, and that made more sense for it. But that was just one where like I remember I went to it and I was like, oh, this is bad. I was so stoked for this, and this is bad. And the last three things. What's the best film of the year to you?
Best film of the
year. Or maybe favorite film. We'll do favorite film of the year.
Favorite film of the year. I kind of want to go outside of ones because I love a lot of the ones we talked about. And Tree of Life, I could go on and on and on.
Yeah.
About. I think Tree of Life is the best film of the year. But outside of that, I think my favorite film of the year is actually Submarine.
Okay.
I made Brandon add this to the list right before we got started recording. Submarine is a Welsh film written and directed by Richard A. Oyeti. I messed it up again, even though we retook it. About a young man coping with his parents' divorce. And I think it's just one of those films, every once in a while you have a movie that comes along that's like a really fresh voice. And that one feels that way. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I remember watching it and just being very delighted by it. And the actor from that has gone on to do Red Oaks on Amazon, which is like one of my favorite shows from the streaming era. Never got a lot of hype to it, but I really love that series. So yeah, that's one I'd throw out for sure.
Okay. I'm trying to think of my favorite film. I do love Midnight in Paris, and that's probably up there for me. I'll say Hugo, because Hugo, it's so magical. I think all performances are great. I think Scorsese does phenomenal things with, it's his love letter to cinema. And it's very interesting in saying comparison, say nowadays with Tarantino's recent film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as his love letter to his version of cinema in the 60s. And I feel like Scorsese's is his love letter to cinema of the stuff he loved, the silent film era, the kind of history of cinema, and why he loves movies. So yeah, I would go with Hugo for that year. The last two questions I had. Oh, what's the it film of the year? Like, what's the movie that's been like that had the most cultural impact on that year? When you think of 2011, this is the movie you think of.
I've already stated my case. I think it's Bridesmaids.
Okay, fair. That's a fair point. I would probably say Drive. I think Drive is just, it's one that has, film lovers Refn is such an interesting director because like nothing he's ever made sadly has like reached the pinnacle of Drive. Like everything after Drive, no one has really attached to the way attached to Drive. And I just think that's like, film people love it. I do think it's a little bit more of a, because I know when that came out, people were upset because they were expecting like a Fast and the Furious type movie, and it's not that at all. I think even a woman sued the studio because of the marketing, because she thought she was walking into a Fast and the Furious type movie, and it was not. It was a gangster film that was just like very quiet, but very dark and brooding, and they were upset by that. I feel like that's the one that's had the biggest impact with people, or the one that people keep going back to over and over again, especially in terms of filmmakers, is Drive. And the last, most important question, does 2011 beat 2010?
All right. I've thought about this because I was looking ahead at the questions.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna equate this just for you, Brandon. I'm gonna make a wrestling metaphor here.
Okay.
If we had... and you correct me if any of this is wrong, because it totally might be. If we had a cage match, 2011 versus 2010, where the strongest fighters came out against each other and were in a cage, I'm going to give it to 2010.
Okay.
I think Social Network is the film of the decade.
Ooh.
If we had a brawl, is that right? What's the one where everybody's just out there and they're like slamming chairs around and
I love trying to explain just like
I know there's one. I don't want to say a tag team. It could be a tag team, but I think there's a better metaphor. I've seen videos where just everyone is in the ring and there's just it's just wild.
It's a battle royale. Battle royale.
If we had a battle royale. Oh, like
battle,
like
battle, I'm sorry, battle royal. Battle royal is what it's called.
If we had a battle royal, I think 2011 would take it. I think there are more strong films in 2011 than were in 2010, but I think there is the strongest film is in 2010.
See, I would agree with you. I feel like it's. I'm gonna say a tie. I know that's a cheap way of doing this, but I agree with you that I think 2010 has the more important films, more seminal films. With I think Social Network. I think you can argue Inception. I think you could probably even argue King's Speech in a way for some people. I think Toy Story 3. I think Tangled is kind of again Disney's animation turn is that year where it becomes what it is today. But I think overall, like if you're judging the average, it's 2011. If you're judging the best, it's 2010. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say. What's some films real quick that we didn't discuss? I know there's a lot that we missed that I wish we discussed.
I think throwing out to Ben who wasn't able to make it, but I know he loves 50-50.
Yeah, he does.
That came out that year. The Muppet, the revitalization of the Muppets was huge for me. Jason Segel bringing the Muppets back that year, really enjoyed that movie. Not too much else. Just a delightful film I recently saw. Salmon Fishing in the Yemen. Just delightful.
I remember liking it, yeah. That was a video store rental, I remember. Ewan McGregor and Emily Blunt. A few of the shout out I'm gonna say. Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Again, going with this idea of genres being subverted and legitimized. It's the spy movie for the modern era. I think Gary Oldman's amazing. I think that's what set him up to be. It's so weird with actors in terms of Oscars, how it's never usually the movie they should win for. It's the next one. And I feel like with Oldman, it was like Tinker Tailor was his setup, his assist in a way for him to actually get the score later with the Oscar with Darkest Hour. I think he's way better in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I don't know if he should have won that year. I don't know if Jean Desjardins for The Artist should have won that year. It's debatable. But I think that's one of Gary Oldman's best films. And I think it's just phenomenal cast. Colin Firth's in that. It's a Danny Strong. Let me see. Gary Oldman, John Hurt, Colin Firth, Mark Strong, Benedict Cumberbatch, Toby Jones, Tom Hardy. It's a great cast and worth checking out. I really love My Week with Marilyn. Michelle Williams is probably one of my favorite actresses that has just not really, she hasn't pushed herself into the mainstream as much as some other actresses of her generation. But those two, and then the one other one I was gonna mention, or We Need to Talk About Kevin, also great. Tilda Swinton, Ezra Miller, Lynn Ramsey's poetic, dark film about a mother whose son was a school shooter, he was a school shooter. And the one I got to mention just because we didn't really talk about it, but the end of Harry Potter, definitely Hallows Part 2. I think that was a very cultural moment for our generation, at least, because that was one of the most popular film franchises of our era. And that was one of the last few films when I remember being in high school that we all had to see opening night. Where you line up, because we don't have reserved seating where I'm from, line up hours in advance to get inside and get the perfect seat. You're all there. All your friends are theater. Nothing else is showing besides Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows Part 2, because it's at midnight and nothing else is there. It's a crazy, crazy time. And so that was a very important film for me in terms of like my college years.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it.
That's 2011, folks.
if you guys want to check out our list, it's on my Letterboxd at Brand Sparks, and the Letterboxd list is called Moneyball, Look at 2011 in Film. Tell us something we missed. Tell us something that you might disagree with our opinions on, and we should add. We'd like to hear what you guys think about the stuff. Make sure you follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at CineNation Show, our Instagram, Facebook, and make sure you buy our merch on tpublic.com. T-shirts, notebooks, hoodies, all that good stuff. Anything else, Thomas?
Buy
that merch. Thomas, always a pleasure. Hopefully we'll have Ben on our next one. But guys, thank you so much for listening. We hope you listen to more episodes soon. Bye.